KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Deep, deep abiding support for KUOW, and then a little breadth. Well, that's in terms of bread. We make this radio station work by your support, transferring the money through this radio station out to all the people who are all around this region and this country and this world who bring you news and information. So our number is 206-543-9595 for you to join our deep and wide level of support, level of news coverage, 1-866-677-5869, or online at kuow.org. The Morning Edition, folks, got you revved up, and now Ann and I are going to come like a freight train right down the tracks and into your homes. We'll try not to be too destructive.
We would like, though, for you to take a brief moment of your morning to make the phone call that you've been meaning to make all week. 206-543-9595 or 866-NPR-KUOW or KUOW.org. Maybe you're listening at work right now. This is how you get your day started, by tuning in to Steve and the crew on weekday. If so, it costs us money to put that sound in your headphones. So give us a ring right now or go online, as you probably already are, as we just discussed, at KUOW.org. Click on the pledge button and make your pledge right now. The
pledge
sooner
banner.
You pledge.
They've made it bigger.
They have a whole banner. You know, you can't miss it. It's really hard not to click on it.
206-543-9595, folks. On Wednesday, some of you have already pledged your support for this spring, and we thank you very much. And some of you are thinking, yeah, we'll get around to it. Don't worry. Well, this is a great time to get around to it, because we want this pledge drive to keep going, chugging down the tracks. It will be a train metaphor morning, and we are stoking the engine. We're going to hear from Ira Glass in a few minutes, because Ira Glass has been on our show a number of times. I went back to 2006. I was curious about what it sounded like when Ira was just working on making This American Life even more relevant to the news of the day. And we're going to hear about that. We're also going to hear a little bit from Garrison Keillor. But we're going to be talking to Maria Semple, who is one of the influential people of Seattle, so declared. And we're gonna talk to her about how that came about. And by way of thanking you and thanking her, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, her novel, which is set in this area, in this town, and Bernadette Fox is her works in the area. Her husband works at Microsoft. It's been a great success, that novel. It's getting turned into a movie. We have 10 of those novels that you can get if you pledge $125, and you will get a signed book of Where'd You Go, Bernadette. We're going to talk to Maria Semple a little bit later. That's one of our thank yous. The most important thank you is when you call, and we thank you for joining us at 206-543-9595.
866-NPR-KUOW. We only have 10 of those books to give away at the $100, $125 pledge level. So get in on it now. 206-543-9595 or 866-NPR-KUOW. Maybe that's just a little nudge that you've been waiting for to make your pledge of support to KUOW, to Weekday, to Steve, to everyone here, and really to yourself, because all the money that comes in, we put right back out in the form of programming that you enjoy. 206-543-9595.
Now, Ann Dornfeld is the education reporter here. And as such, she brings us new education stories all the time. And as such, we'll talk about that in a moment, because apparently I wasn't looking at my clock. Bernard?
Why, thank you, Steve. I'm just here to let people know that it's 51 degrees in Seattle, quite a few clouds, but those are expected to go away and leave us with a mostly sunny afternoon and a high today of 62.
KUOW would like to acknowledge the businesses that have donated food and beverages throughout our pledge drive, especially Stumptown Coffee Roasters, Top Pot Donuts, and the Bagel Deli. Thank you for supporting KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the Everett Clinic, offering a wide range of minimally invasive, high-tech surgical techniques, including laparoscopy, surgical robotics, and image-guided surgery. More at everettclinic.com/tech.
Where'd You Go, Bernadette is about Bernadette Fox, and she's a fearfully intelligent woman who has gotten so vexed by Seattle that she's hired a virtual assistant in India to run even her most basic errands.
That was really all I tried to do, is just tell my story and not have bad writing in it, which I felt like I could recognize. I didn't even know if I could recognize good writing. I just felt like I could recognize bad writing, and I didn't want to do it.
It's Maria Semple talking about her book and her work, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Boy, ripped from the headlines, hiring a virtual assistant to do her work. And didn't we just have that happen a few months ago, where somebody was discovered having hired somebody in India to do his actual work so he could just hang out and watch video games, play video games, if I'm not mistaken. Wasn't that right?
That's what I recall.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to hear from Maria Semple in a little bit. I just remind you, only two books left at the $125 level, signed book, Where'd You Go, Bernadette. Maria Semple will be here in a little bit. So join in this morning at 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869. We are looking to hear from you right now. So Ira Glass and This American Life have been around for a little while now, and they have become very influential in the media world. I think that's fair to say. When you listen to The Daily Show, when you listen to Planet Money, which of course was a spinoff of This American Life, when you even listen to Colbert, even the tone you hear in some of the news interview shows, I think it's fair to say that This American Life's tone has permeated that sort of more conversational, we're bringing out the ideas through just more human interaction. Do you think you agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that Ira made it okay to stammer a bit, to stutter, to give some pauses and to sound more like a human being instead of someone buttoned down sitting in Washington, D.C. And I think that was a real gift to public radio.
And I asked him about that back in 2006, and I said that very thing, you know, and he agreed with it. He said, yeah, what we've done is allowed for a change of tone.
It's people talking about the news in a normal tone of voice. That is the thing about The Daily Show that's really refreshing, is you feel like these aren't like news robot people talking to the other news robots in the news robot language. They seem like normal people with the normal reactions that one has to the news. And in our show, the same thing. Like when we've done, you know, stories, you know, out on the aircraft carrier, you know, during the war in Afghanistan, or with Haider Akbar, who's a teenager whose family's from Afghanistan, who did stuff for us, or just everything we've done in the war on terror, actually. When we went out with the mercenaries in Iraq, who are, you know, fighting for the U.S. as, you know, hired guns, basically. You know, it's all in a tone of voice where you feel like we're not talking like official news presenters, but we're just talking the way you would talk to your friend who you're trying to explain something to. And so the stories can be funny, and they can be emotional, and they just have like more human range than a traditional like news presenter, and even more range than I think the license that one generally takes on the NPR news shows, where I have to say people take quite a bit of license. And you know, if you think about what Scott Simon does or what some of the really good reporters do, like they have like scenes and characters and funny moments and emotional moments, like it's all in the vocabulary of what we do in public radio. So I think there's that. So I think that there's that in common.
The Nancy Updike did that report with the mercenaries, right?
Is
that
And that
was when she was with the contractors as well.
Yeah, and basically this is before things got especially bad in Iraq. She was actually there when the four contractors were hung up on that bridge, and that's when things sort of took a horrible turn for the worse in April of 2003, I guess, or 2004. And basically we had read about these military contractors and also about people in Iraq, you know, who were going over to do laundry for the army, you know, and to do, you know, all the sort of basic jobs that you don't need to be a fully trained soldier to do, the laundry, the cooking the meals, stuff like that. And we all had this question of like, who are these people who just thought like, oh, I'm going to be a cook in Baghdad. Like, that's my next career move, you know, and. Like, who are these people? Because one third of the Americans now in Baghdad, you know, as part of our war effort there, are people who are just private contractors. And so we wanted to know who they were and what is it about. And these mercenaries, these guys who, you know, it isn't just like they're escorting, you know, U.S. convoys and stuff. Like, the people who are protecting the top people running, you know, the top U.S. people in the country, you know, are private contractors, and they have helicopters and they have tanks. I mean, it's not just like, you know, guys with rifles. It's a huge, huge thing. And so we just wanted to know, like, who are they? And they turned out to be really funny, interesting guys and really patriotic guys. Like interestingly, like most of them were ex-military and most of them were pretty idealistic guys for guys who were in there just to make a buck.
Did that show, and also the show you did on the aircraft carrier, did that show open more opportunities for you to talk to military people, or did it close doors?
No, it's open. I mean, honestly, like we've used those shows as calling cards to make other stories and things happen. When we did the aircraft carrier show, that was really early in the war on terror. It was very soon after 9/11. And truthfully, we were really nervous when we put that on the air because it was so different from what everybody else in the media was doing. That is, we went onto this aircraft carrier, and instead of, at the time, like everybody went onto the same aircraft carrier. It was the USS Stennis, and they were flying missions over Afghanistan during the war in Afghanistan. And MTV was there, and NBC was there, and CNN was there. Like everybody, you know, you'd go on for 3 or 4 days, and then they'd take you off. And everybody did these sort of very corny, you know, specials about, like, you know, these brave men and women in harm's way. And there was something very cartoonish about the way people were writing about the people on the ship. And instead, we simply tried to document what's it like to be a sailor or a Marine on that ship. And as the people on the ship would tell you, you know, people would say to us, like we're fighting Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Neither has an Air Force or a Navy. Like, we're so much safer here than we would be back home in San Francisco. You know, like, this is so much safer. You know, they're surrounded by a armada of 10 ships, you know, 2 nuclear-powered submarines and a destroyer. And, you know, just like you know, they felt like they were much safer there than out. And really, like, we did a lot of stuff with, like, the people who do all the little jobs that you would never hear about. Our show opens with a teenager whose job it is to fill vending machines. That's her job in the war on terror, is that she puts Snickers bars into vending machines for you know, 10 hours a day. And you know, it's a really funny, lively show. And, you know, like, we're a patriotic show. Like, the name of the show is This American Life. Like, you know, but we're not patriotic in that kind of corny way. And we were really nervous that this is just a little soon. Like, this is a little too different from what other people are doing. And then the main people who contacted us afterwards were Navy people saying, like, that's exactly what it feels like to be on one of those ships. Like, thank you. That was very nice.
Ira Glass back in 2006 talking about how they think about their news, their media, how they set a tone. But I like the ending there, how they are not afraid to tell the stories they think are honest and real. And then, sure enough, the people that are subject to those stories more often than not say, yeah, let's be honest, let's be real, let's not be fake about it, let's not be making it propaganda. I think that's what public radio does. That was a great story for that. Hence me pulling it, Ann Dornfeld, because I thought that was interesting. All right, so another star. Do we have stars in public radio? Garrison Keillor's a star, host of Prayer Home Companion. He joined us for the pledge drive in 2007. So that gave me the opportunity to ask him a question I've wondered about for a long time. And I know you have too. When you listen to the credits at the end of Prayer Home Companion, the first writer he always credits is Sarah Bellum. You know, it's the brain, right? That coordinates muscle activity, balance. It helps you be who you are. It helps you be creative. But he always makes it seem like she's a real person. I asked him, I said, is Sarah Bellum a real person, or are you just joking? Is that just a joking credit to yourself? Because everybody knows you write the show. It's your own brain writing the show. So I asked him that.
Sarah Bellum?
Yeah. A real person?
Oh, yes, of course.
What's she look like?
You have a producer, don't you?
Yes.
Yes.
Katie Sewell.
Yeah, Katie Sewell. Well, Sarah Bellum is kind of my Katie Sewell.
Really?
Yeah.
A flesh and blood person.
Exactly. Lovely young woman, dark hair, and, you know, wearing a very fetching brown outfit.
All right. I looked for pictures of her.
Talking about
Katie.
Talking about Sarah Bellum right now.
Oh, okay. Because I've looked for pictures of her, and I you know.
It's radio. We don't, you know, we don't. I don't want to pay her any more than I'm paying her right now, so I don't like to build her up too much.
Okay, fair enough. All right, you may relax now, unless you feel like weighing in, because now it's the fundraising time, the bread and butter time of public radio. Perhaps if you want to whip off a few more courses, but yes, please. I wish you would, if you have one to sing to take us into this.
I can't improve on what you've already done. Hey, we're ready to go. We're here once again to ask for your dough. It's the best we can do. It's all that we know. Harmony now in this. Pledge time again on public radio.
Very
good. You're a little slow, but that's
okay. I was forgetting what the lines were. I apologize. That's Garrison Keillor. High point of my career, Garrison Keillor singing a song that I wrote. A very clever song, I hope you noticed. Katie Sewell.
Yes.
You worked at Prairie Home Companion.
Yes.
You were wandering the backstages. You were helping put the show together. You even talked to many of the writers.
No.
Right?
Right.
Did you ever meet Sarah Bellum?
Never did.
Yeah. I'm still holding out for the fact that Sarah Bellum is just his fantasy made flesh in his mind. That's very good. You never met her?
Never met her.
Met the other writers?
Met one of the other two. So I didn't meet the third either.
Yeah. You didn't meet? Oh, really?
So maybe they're all imaginary. No. I know that two of them are not imaginary people.
The man is amazing. He writes that show and he does so much work. It's pretty amazing. Just real quick, remind us, your job for part of that show when you were there was to do what? You went out to a small town that you were going to be doing the live show from.
You're right. I drove to Appleton, Wisconsin from his house in Minnesota, and I staked it out. I talked to people around town, figured out what they found funny, what kind of work they were in, what arguments they were having currently, and reported back to him about all those details.
And that was rolled into?
That's rolled into what he ends up writing as the show content, because that's how you determine what's going to cause the laugh, is by figuring out what it is that those people find funny.
All right, a little behind the scenes. That was Garrison Keillor. We are here today. We're asking for your support, Public Radio.
I'm Shankar Vedantham. I'm a science correspondent in NPR, and I do stories that look at human behavior and the social sciences. A few weeks ago, I did a piece that looked at how kids learn to deal with money and how they become responsible. There's been a lot of interesting research over the years that shows that some kids are very good at what's called delayed gratification, that if you sit them before a table, for example, and you put a marshmallow on the table and you tell them, if you wait for 15 minutes and don't eat the marshmallow, I'll give you two marshmallows. Now, some children are very good at waiting for 15 minutes, so now they can eat two marshmallows. But there are other kids who can't wait. They have to eat the marshmallow right away. And over the years, people have used this marshmallow experiment to make the argument that some people are just inherently impulsive, and some people are inherently cautious and able to plan for the future. And on the one hand, the study was very powerful because it did predict how these children eventually went on to become young adults. It predicted all kinds of things about their academic performance, their careers, you know, what kind of lives they led. But it was a demoralizing study in many ways because it suggested that, you know, what made you a spender or a saver was really fixed from the time that you were 4 years old, that it was something to do with your brain chemistry and there was very little that you could do about it. So I was very happy when a few weeks ago I read a study which actually suggested that no, there actually is an enormous role that parents and families can play in raising children to be more financially responsible. I spoke with this wonderful researcher at the University of Arizona, Joyce Cerrito, and she told me that families that tend to bring children into financial discussions, those families tended to raise children who, when they became young adults, behaved much more responsibly when it came to financial decision making. And so, you know, during Pledge Drive, I have to say that this is not only an opportunity for you to help your local public radio station, but it's an opportunity for you to educate your children about something that's really important for their financial future. So having a conversation with your children, not only where you tell them that you're giving money to your public radio station, but why you're making this financial decision rather than spending the money on something else. You know, the payoff is not just hours and hours of wonderful listening on the radio. The payoff is you're going to be raising wonderfully responsible children.
All right. Did you listen to a lot of that? Is that you? Is that the kind of work you do, Ann Dornfeld?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is, it's interesting because in looking at in my year of education reporting, I found that there's a real...
By the way, is that the title of your next book? My Year of Education Reporting.
It would be a pretty short book, but I studied science in school, and my background is in science reporting. And it sounds like Chakram's background is in science as well. And what I've discovered in my year of education reporting is that there's a real struggle in educational theory between the sort of religion and science, and I don't mean religion in the strict sense, but religion and what people believe works versus the evidence of what appears to work or what should work. And so it's been really interesting kind of exploring that conflict. We see that a lot in education these days, and I try to delve as deeply as possible into it. So if that sort of reporting is the kind of reporting that you want to hear more of, please give us a call right now. 206-543-9595, 866-NPR-KUOW or KUOW.org.
I just want to say, in a way you took that tone, because, of course, one of the faiths you're looking at is the faith of whether charter schools, how charter schools work. And you have looked at, well, what do the reports tell us? What does the science tell us? And it's, you know, it's different sometimes.
Right. Well, I think we all have an idea of what should work, and what should work may or may not be what is going to work. And it may work with one kid and not another. We want to hear from some new members right now, people who have never pledged to KUOW. There are a lot of you listening right now and a lot of you about to make the phone call to 206-543-9595. That's faith right there, Steve. 866-NPR-KUOW or KUOW.org. We need to hear from you this morning. We have a $12,000 goal during weekday, and we are only $2,182 of the way there, so we need to hear from you.
You know why we're going to get there? We're going to get there because in Seattle, there's a certain type of person who cares, who is committed, who will step out of their way to make things happen. And sometimes those people are fun to look at and talk about and write about. How's that for transition? Maria Semple is the author of the best-selling book, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Follows the recluse Bernadette Fox and her family as they try to navigate the cultural nuances of their new home in Seattle. Did you know that Seattle would have cultural nuances when you moved here?
It didn't really occur to me, in fact, that that it would be much different from Los Angeles or where I was from. That really was obviously naive on my part, but they certainly hit me smack hard, and so it took quite some getting used to.
Maria Semple has written for television, for Arrested Development, Ellen, Mad About You, Beverly Hills 90210, which does not quite compute with the others, and we'll ask about that. Her writing has also appeared in The New Yorker. Where'd You Go, Bernadette is her second novel. She lives in Seattle. You are a listener to public radio.
I'm a big listener. I listen to it every morning on the way to dropping my daughter off on the when I bring her back. So anything that I have to say of interest, I probably heard it on NPR.
Was so, and there is also much to enjoy and make fun of in the world of public radio.
Yes.
Did you, in the driving and in the hearing and in the listening to the local as well as the national, did that what started you on thinking about the cultural differences, the cultural nuances?
Well, the cultural nuances didn't really come, I have to say, sorry, from
that's fine.
From weekday.
I'm just throwing things out.
Yeah, thank you. You know, but I will say that when I first moved here and I knew nobody, I was driving around just to various parks with my daughter and going to cultural events, and I really hit some clams, as they say, some pretty. I went to an old folks' home performance of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella.
You took your daughter to that?
Yeah, because I didn't know. I didn't know where it was or who this company was.
How old was your daughter at the time?
She was six, and so and I went to all these random places, and it was only when I was listening to you one morning interviewing Brian Greene, the physicist, and you said, "Hey, he'll be at Town Hall tonight," and I just had never had anything to do. I knew nobody. I showed up. It was sold out, a line around the block, and that was my first little hint that this city might be someplace special.
Ah, how interesting. Brian Greene, he blows our minds, and we like that up here, I think.
And he makes it so easy. Yeah, and you feel smart for a moment. In fact, I wrote about Brian Greene right at the end of my book, where I have Bernadette describing a physicist that who's explaining the quilted universe to her, and she says, like everything else, I got it, I lost it. Because for one moment you understand it, and then it just vanishes.
You're doing a thing at Town Hall with Nancy Pearl. Oh, tonight at 6:30, sold out.
Yes, 7:30 sold.
Oh, it's 7:30?
Mm-hmm. VIP cocktail party.
Yeah, that's what's, yeah.
Yeah.
With those 100 influential people, I hope we'll all be there.
Yes.
Have you been on Town Hall stage?
No, I am so excited.
Have you? But you've been there enough to mingle with the folks who come.
Oh, yes. Oh, I go all the time. I'm a constant presence at Town Hall.
People are experts.
Yes.
At Town Hall.
Uh-oh, don't start scaring me.
No, in a good way.
Yes.
It is an engaged conversation. It's not a passive group in the audience, right?
No.
Which is what I imagine you would like.
Yes.
I mean, the active people.
Yeah, and Nancy Pearl, who I've never met before, is going to be interviewing me, so that'll be really fun just to even meet her for the first time in front of 800 people.
That'll be good.
Yes, to see me starstruck.
All right, so Arrested Development, Ellen, Mad About You, Beverly Hills 90210.
Which of these things doesn't belong?
Yeah. Which of these things is not like the other?
Beverly Hills 90210 was my first job, and I got it because I was, I grew up in Aspen, Colorado, and I was one winter skiing, and on the chairlift, I met this guy named Darren Starr, who was there with his parents, and he had just gotten a deal to do a TV show in L.A., which would become Beverly Hills 90210. And we became friends. We skied together and hung out. And at the time, I was living in L.A., but I had just come back to Christmas to be with my family. And so when I got back to L.A., he said, "Hey, you're kind of smart and interesting. You want to work on the show?" And,
really? That's how it went?
You know, I had written...
The fairy dust gods were...
I think maybe I'm making a little more fairy dust, but I was a screenwriter at the time. I'd written screenplays, and so I had a body of work. It wasn't just that. I mean, L.A.
is
that
skiing.
Magical. No, but it was, I live in L.A., I'm a writer, you're a writer, and so we met just kind of socially and randomly, and then he gave me a job on the show, and that... At first, I watched the pilot and saw a few episodes, and it seemed hilariously corny and earnest to me. And so when I got into the writer's room and expressed as such of how corny and earnest it was, it did not go over very well. And that was when I realized I was probably a comedy writer and not a drama writer, because the dramas take themselves extremely seriously, and there's a lot of... talk of issues and how to best manage it, and the comedy rooms are very different. The most disrespectful place in America.
Issues within the show or issues that are in society that we bring into the drama?
Yes, that. Yes, issues about how do we treat this well, you know, how do we treat this carefully and tenderly, and so there's a lot of that stuff which I had no patience for and I just thought was ridiculous.
What did you contribute to Beverly Hills 90210?
I wrote the Color Me Bad episode, which was actually quite a famous episode in the annals of the show, which Color Me Bad was a boy group. And it was when Donna, who was Tori Spelling, went to go sneak into the hotel to meet Color Me Bad, and in the hallway saw her mother, who was actually in the same hotel having an affair.
Well, I see. So that's where the serious part came in.
That was very serious.
But it sounds funny.
It was actually pretty fun. It's such a cheesy episode that people are always bringing it up. It's a favorite.
Did you go back to writing comedy having learned something from that experience, other than that you were a comedy writer and not a drama writer? I mean, something about the writing or the setting up, the craft itself?
Yes. On every show, you learn about characters and you learn about story. And I think that even, you know, one of the kind of contradictions is that even on bad shows, you know, quote unquote bad shows, and not even that was a bad show, but on every show is filled with really talented writers and really smart people. And if it doesn't come together into a hit show, then that just is what happens. You never kind of can account if magic will happen. And I've been on shows that was kind of a murderer's row of talent and stars, and then it just didn't work. And then you get a show like Arrested Development, where Mitch Hurwitz had written for the Golden Girls and, you know, just kind of odd shows that, that you would never think that somebody could kind of make history writing a pilot. You know, there was nothing in his past to kind of suggest that he was capable of this, and it was a bunch of no names. Many of them were just cast. It was their first job ever, and then suddenly it was magic.
So there is that sort of indescribable thing that happens, that magic that nobody has yet kind of figured out. Well, this could work, this will work, let's put these two people together and that'll give us that. It's all in the end, you talent in place, and we're gonna massage it the way we can.
Yes, it and you never know going in, and there's so many big, you know, the big pilots. This is pilot season now, where they're putting all the pilots together, and I read about them, and they're things that sound like they will be brilliant, and then they'll never get picked up, and because it just couldn't translate.
That's funny. So Where'd You Go, Bernadette? How far along is the movie project?
The script is being written now, and I
not
think,
by you?
No, I didn't write the script. I felt like it would be too hard, frankly, because there's so many letters and rants and kind of flashbacks and stuff that I couldn't figure out structurally the best way to do it. But we hired these writers who wrote The 500 Days of Summer, which is a really darling movie that's nonlinear and funny and has great character work. And so I really have faith that they're going to be able to crack the structure mainly, I think, is the beast in the adaptation.
Because the book is a series of letters.
Yes, yeah. Series of letters, and there's jokes, you know, with receipts. I don't know how you put that up on the screen, and report cards and things like that. But if anyone can do it, these guys can.
You're one of the producers, though.
I am a producer. And the screenwriters came up last December, and I showed them Microsoft and brought them to the top of the Space Needle for dinner and showed them where I thought Bernadette's house was. And they got a vibe of Seattle, and I think they're going to do a great job.
Did you talk about the Seattle vibe that you wanted them to find? I mean, you showed them these places. What did you tell them?
I told them, I basically drove around and expressed annoyance at almost everything I saw, which was not hard to do, which
like what?
Comes naturally. Well, a lot of it's in my book, like five-way intersections, that where you have to wait forever to go through the light, where you think, oh, this street, oh, I'll just go across along this street, but then there's the 5 freeway in the way, and there's no way to get across it. Of just how the slow pace compared to Los Angeles, that, and I've now absorbed the slow pace, I must say, at least in driving and in interactions with business people. But they found it very mellow and slow paced.
So I get the driving part, though. I think we're much further along towards other regions than we might have been. You can answer me on that, but first, the business interactions, slow pace, what do those seem like?
When I first moved here, and I was buying a mattress, I didn't even have a bed yet, and I went to buy a mattress at Macy's and said, looked at some mattresses and said, hey, I'd like to, hey, can somebody help me buy with a mattress? And the woman said, you're not from here, are you? You're not from around here. And I said, why do you say that? She said, it's just your energy, or you're from New York. And I didn't quite know what that meant. And I thought, wait, all I'm doing is asking to be helped in a mattress store, and apparently I have to switch to decaf, you know, which is what she then told me. And so I still, it's kind of a mystery to me, but I think that there's kind of maybe it's just me, but, or what you bring from LA or New York, that you have kind of an amped up, you know, you kind of come loaded for bear just when you're about to, you know, just order your coffee or something.
All right, so now you've been here a while, you said you've absorbed a little bit. Are you in a coffee shop and you see those amped up East Coast people?
Oh yeah.
What do you think?
Go home, we don't want you here. But like every good transplant, I want to close the gate behind me, that I'm the last one allowed.
When's that movie coming out?
I don't know. The movie
hasn't been shot yet.
Exactly. The movie is, we have great producers and the screenwriter, but we need to get a director, then an actress. And the movie is on the way to getting made, but that often means it's on the way to having something terribly wrong happens so it does not get made. So we'll see.
We'll find out about that. All right. You came in part to throw down. Did you not?
Oh, yeah. I'm
What's
throwing
your
down.
Challenge for our in case you forget, I hand you this piece of paper.
So I have made a $1,000 challenge. And if we can get 10 pledges at $100, then you get my $1,000.
So Seattle Met in their People and Profiles magazine named you one of the 50 most influential people in Seattle right now. You're right. You're first, along with Allison Williams, Josh Feit, Katherine Robinson, Laura Cassidy, Matthew Halverson, Seth Sommerfeld. So we're throwing down to those people. We're just telling those people, specifically we're calling them out, and we're saying they should call and pledge at 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869, and everybody else. Call right now.
We've heard from a lot of people this morning. Joanne and Friday Harbor Pledge saying, so good to hear Bill Radke on KUOW again. We all agree. Jeanette in Seattle Pledge giving a shout out to all the fabulous folks on Fifth Ave. And we heard from Stephen on Bainbridge Island, who pledged, saying he appreciates KUOW every day on his commute. All these folks are doing it, and now it is your turn to call 206-543-9595 or 866-NPR-KUOW.
Because you know what? You make a list, but list or no list, what makes us influential are the actions we take, and sure, we are asking you to be influential in supporting public radio. And we're asking you to help Maria give away $1,000 by calling 206-543-9595 right now. This is a good time to do it. I don't know why you would wait when you can do it. And then you could also then call up Ed Murray or Eric Tanaka or C.R. Douglas and say, hey, as an influence maker, influential person, you should also be calling. Because I already showed my influence by calling at 206-543-9595.
There's a good chance they've already pledged as well, though. You know, Rima did.
You mean these influence
those
makers?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Rima said, thanks for the fantastic programming. I listen every morning and evening during my commute. Marsha loves KUOW and pledged. And Elizabeth says, I'm donating this time around in honor of my 11-month-old son, a new member. I joked before he was born that I spend so much time listening to KUOW that he'd recognize and be comforted by NPR as much as my husband and I are. He does love it. Thanks, Elizabeth. 206-543-9595, 866-NPR-KUOW. What's your reason for pledging? Let folks know when you call, and they'll pass it to us, and we will share it with the world.
Sure, Sally Jewell's influential. Sure, Andrew Russell, Intimon Theater Artistic Director, is influential. Sure, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis are influential, and I would like them all to call. But you're influential. You're important. Because you're listening, and we need your help. And you can look around yourself and say, you know, community is built when each of us decides to take action. And we're just asking you to take that action now. We have a $1,000 challenge on the table. Or I guess you're going to take it off the table, right? I asked if you were going to bring $1,001 bills. I wish you could stack them up. Because Maria will leave, taking it back with her, unless you call at 206-543-9595. Pledge $100, 10 folks pledging $100 to help us meet our goal, our overall goal of $12,000. We get there one call at a time, and we're looking for your call right now at 206-543-9595. If you haven't made that call yet, think about the things that influence your life and how you learn, and you know that public radio is going to be a big part of it because it keeps you informed. So we're looking for your call. 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869. If you don't feel like calling, you can always pledge online at kuow.org. There are folks who will take your call. There's the bits and bytes that will process your information. But what we're looking for you to say, hey, they're talking to me. Give us a call.
Thank you.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, offering walk, talk, and taste tours at each store. PCC nutrition educators guide the way and explore the many choices in organic produce, sustainably raised products, and bulk foods. Sampling and questions are encouraged. More at pcccooks.com.
We're talking with Maria Semple, whose book, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, is being turned into a movie, who has lived here and has been thought of as an influence maker, and I want to talk to you about that. And we're waiting for your call to help us meet our challenge at 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869, $1,000 on the table. Never like a person in front of me who's put the money down. It's a little intimidating.
Scary.
Yeah. And if you pledge $100, 10 folks, we will meet this goal. So I know that a magazine or newspaper or radio station saying, oh, you're an influence maker, is what it is. So what is it? What does it do for you to be named that way? Does it make you think anything at all?
Well, it immediately made me pick up the phone and cancel the 4th of July fireworks.
Thank you.
They're going to say that it was budget cuts, but it was just me making some calls. You know, it was really bumming my dog out. So I just thought that I should be using my influence for just some personal gain.
Very good. Very good. Thank you for that, because, you know, nobody wanted that.
I know, exactly.
That's a good use of power right there.
All the smiley faces up there and the fireworks, we've all seen that too many times, and the beautiful music. Enough.
Enough of that.
Yeah.
Is this city still inspirational to you in terms of writing?
Not really, I have to say, in the same way, because I wrote the book when I was new to the city and I didn't understand it and I didn't like it. And I felt really alienated here and like nobody kind of got me. And so that's where that was really, I think the book is a new is a new arrival's view of the city. And so, and I'm really grateful that I was able to kind of capture it at the time, because now
we've lost it.
Oh, I've totally lost it. Yeah. And in fact, when I kind of understood that my character would be this woman who had personal problems, but blamed an entire city of people she didn't meet and the street layout for her personal problems instead of taking personal responsibility, I knew that I had a lot to work with, because it was all I was thinking about. So I was writing it down. And then every now and then I'd do something like drive by those beautiful hanging baskets of flowers downtown and I'd go, aw. And then I'd say, stop, I can't think that yet. You know, I still want to kind of preserve this irrational hatred of the city until my first draft is done, and then I can go back to I can start liking the place.
So when the writers came up and you drove them around and tried to be angry, were they in the back, what were they in the back thinking about your attitude?
They left... when we were at the spot where I thought Bernadette's house is, on the kind of in the top of Queen Anne, the west side of it, and where there's a big mudslide in the book, and where I was showing them where I thought the mudslide would be, and they turned to me and they said, "The book now makes no sense at all. Why would anyone who lives in this beautiful place be so filled with hatred?" And so they kind of like really blew their minds, because they both want to move up here. They love it. They're now trying to figure out a way to move here. They totally didn't see the negative in it. They I think just left thinking that I was crazier than they did on the way up.
Can I ask you a question, Ann?
Sure.
Where were you born?
Seattle.
Yeah. What neighborhood?
I was born on 15th Avenue East.
And your family, how long has your family been here?
37 years.
Oh, they moved just because you're just a spring chicken. So
yeah, I was.
They moved when
I was on the way at the time. Mm-hmm.
So when you hear, and I also a transplant, but really, you know, 1979, I almost have roots. What do you think about how your city has changed and all the folks who have come to take over?
Yeah, I mean, I think that like anything, there's you know, pluses and minuses.
I just want the minuses.
Okay, the minuses. you know, when I watch a movie like Singles, I get really nostalgic for the gritty bell town that was, and just kind of the Seattle had a much more working class feel when I was growing up, and I grew up in Ballard, and it was just, Ballard was not a place of, you know, $750,000 houses back then. It was a place of $30,000 houses, and it was a lot more humble.
So Maria, if this isn't inspiring you, you maybe either need to go plumb the past or
move.
Everett?
Yes.
Mukilteo?
Yeah, I have no idea where the inspiration is going to come from next, but I'm going to just wait for it to hit. And I have faith. If it takes years, then it'll take years. I'm in no rush.
You're writing another novel right now?
No.
So you're just taking it easy?
I'm taking it easy.
You've taught a few times.
Yes, at Hugo House. I love teaching at the Hugo House. I love that organization. And so I'm reading and I'm going out on the road for the paperback for this book. And I'm just taking it easy because I think it's important to have downtime. I think it's important for novelists to be alone and observing the world. And I think it takes years to become a different person. I think it's important to be a different person with each novel that you write. I think the power comes from that.
Oh, that's very interesting. A different person. You've not necessarily talking about maturity, but we're talking about experience and just change.
Yeah, and I look at Where'd You Go, Bernadette, and I hardly recognize the person who wrote that because it really captures a moment in time when I was unhappy and confused, and I've worked through that, and so I just think, who is that person who wrote that crazy book?
When you are teaching at Hugo House, you're teaching people who are either starting out as novelists or people who have finished and want to get some feedback and also get some structural ideas. How easy is it to teach? I imagine it would be easy to teach the structure. How easy is it to teach the more creative aspect?
I don't think you can teach the creative aspect. And I get this question a lot about being funny, about, oh, how can you
teach? How can I be funny?
Yeah, and I don't think you can. I mean, I think that you either are or you are not. I think that you have an outlook that you know, I'll walk down the street and see some horrific thing, and I'll come home and say to my boyfriend, I just saw the most hilarious thing, you know, because I just happened to see it as funny. And I think there are people who view the world that way. I think a lot of it has to do with unhappy, harrowing childhoods. But at least on the plus side, you have a funny outlook on life. And so I try to... when I teach, more teach the structure, I mainly try to teach making the book entertaining and connecting to the reader.
What is that? Making the book entertaining is about what? A performance?
Yeah, the way that I put it is that how to keep the reader wanting to keep reading, and to me, I think that every book should be a mystery. I think every book should be from page one, you just want to know what's going on. You know, even if it's not literally a mystery, I just think there needs to be some kind of intrigue and something you want to know, that the book should always be kind of casting forward in the reader's mind. And so I think that those are techniques that you can teach, or just I think it's an important thing to always be thinking about.
I was wondering what the most common mistakes that you see writers making are. How do you correct them?
The most common mistake, I think, is not understanding what story is. I'm a big story junkie, and I like novels that tell a story and you're involved in the story. And I think that that people who are starting out wanting to be novelists, they think it's kind of language or what's in their head and that's what needs to be on the page. And that's all well and good. And I think that there's obviously you want good language and you want what's in your head to make it to the page. But first and foremost, you're a storyteller. And what I find is that people don't know what that means. And my background as a television writer, all we do in the rewrite room is just story, 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 story. You know, you come up with an idea and I'll say, oh, I went into KUOW this morning and said I'd give $1,000 pledge, but I don't have $1,000. And then they made the pledge, and now I'm trapped. And what do I do? Like, that seems like the beginning of a funny story. And in the rewrite room, you figure out, okay, what are the scenes? What happens? How do you make that entertaining and funny? And so I have a really strong muscle developed about how to turn just a little moment into a story. And so I feel like that's the kind of thing that I can teach, and it strangely is not offered in books. I mean, there's some screenwriting books, which actually I tell novelists to look at, because that's where you learn story.
I was going to ask you about how you turned it into a story, but you already did. You already started that way. You already started down that road about scenes. All right, so you have graced our chat room, our stomptish, as Bernard likes to call it. So, all right, Sacramento Kings, we're trying to take them away from Sacramento. We want a basketball team. How should we feel about that aspect, that we're taking it from Sacramento, if we can get it?
I think why would we care about Sacramento? Because nobody cared about us when they took our team. I know that's not very Christian of me, but I feel like we deserve a team, right? I mean, they took our team away from us before we moved here, so it wasn't even us at the time. But the injury is still alive in me. and one of the things that really baffles me about Seattle, and in fact it's from a lot of listening to your show, is just that there's even a con about – there's pros – you know, the pros and cons of bringing the team back. Why would anyone not want a team here? I mean, I listen to these – I know the answers, but it's like, wow, that is some rarefied politics, the people not wanting some rich guy to pay for a basketball team in Seattle. It's like, I'll take it. We live across the street from the Key Arena. I'm already
Oh, you're already getting ready.
Oh, I'm getting ready. We're walking across. Yeah, all I hope is that they don't leave the Key Arena, but I'll have to use my influence to somehow kill the new Soto Arena so it stays in Key Arena.
So you canceled the fireworks with your influence.
Yes.
And it looks like the sequester has canceled the Blue Angels. What should we do this summer?
Go to the islands and check out the farm stands.
Oh, that's very Seattle of you.
Yes, it is. That's my favorite thing. That's the thing I'm most looking forward to, is we have a house on Vashon, and I can't wait to start doing the rounds of the little serve-yourself honor farm stands.
That's right.
Just enough to break your heart.
And you honor it, right? You pay for the eggs.
Oh, yeah. And I pay more, because look at my pledge.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
You are stepping up. All right. That nobody wants our compost? We were trying to send our compost out to Eastern Washington. They don't really want it. People don't want our compost. What should we do with our compost? Should we be composting it in the city, do you think?
This is new to me. So that's
people don't want our smelly compost.
Wow.
You compost, right? You.
Oh, totally. I totally compost. And I compost out on Vashon, and I dug a big pit. I was actually told that you don't have to get that fancy with the compost. You just dig a pit and throw your trash
so
in.
So there you go. There you go. Folks that are living in Madison Valley, just dig a hole.
Dig a hole, throw it in, and just put some kind of board on top of it. Really, that's what I was told. I'm going to start doing that this summer. I'll get back to you and see with the raccoon problem that I will have.
Maria Semple and Nancy Pearl are going to be at Town Hall tonight. VIPs at 6:30, and then it starts at 7:30. I think we're all VIPs, so let's just show up and get a drink. The event is sold out, but, you know, knock on the door. Maria Semple put up a challenge, $1,000. She has $1,000 bills sitting on the table. You're going to have to leave them because we met our challenge. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was really great. You made it happen because people said, oh, I think I'll be influential. Now, of course, next year, you'll have to come back, or even in the fall.
I'll always be here for KUOW. I love you guys.
That is a great phrase. I like that. All right, so thank you very much. We met our challenge. Maria is going to leave $1,000 bills, but I guess we have more to do, right?
Maria has made it rain, and now it is your turn. Give us a call at 206-543-9595 or 866-NPR-KUOW. We heard from William, who says, I love KUOW. I've been listening almost every day for years now and have always wanted to pledge, but I'm finally doing it. Give a shout out to my mom, Charlie, in Squamish, and get her to pledge. All right, Charlie. 866-NPR-KUOW. If you're listening on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, wherever you're listening, now's the time to make that call.
I'll tell you what. Oh, go ahead. You do that first.
206-543-9595.
I apologize. Or 1-866-677-5869. I'll tell you what, since Maria just boosted the island's economy even more coming this summer, because everybody's going to be going to the Honor Farm stands, and you said Suquamish, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Vashon, San Juan Islands, Whidbey Island. You folks, we'd like to hear from you right now. You have all these fine signals coming your way out in Bellingham, all the way out into the Lummi Island, 206-543-9595. I believe we have thrown down the challenge, since people will be driving around this summer honoring your farm stands and paying for the eggs, maybe paying a little more. Can you pay a little bit to support this service you're using? 206-543-9595. This is the time to do it. We're talking to you. You're listening. And we'd like you to join us. 1-866-677-5869.
KUOW is your all-day, everyday honor system farm stand. I don't think that you would ever go to one of those farm stands offering daffodils or eggs or strawberries and think, oh, look, sweet, free strawberries.
Free.
I don't think that would occur to you. That is not your way. So that should not be your way either when it comes to KUOW, which... you know and love, and you don't know those strawberries are going to be the best you've ever tasted, but you do know that KUOW is your favorite public radio station, more likely your favorite radio station. So give us a call, 866-NPR-KUOW, 206-543-9595, or go to
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.